with God's help, this evening, I would like to say a few things that may be regarded as a continuation of the last two talks, some further points about what we Christians have neglected, having entered the new year without making any new resolutions. As you know, Christ grants us more time so that we may use it well, think, take stock, weigh things carefully, and make the appropriate decisions. As I have said before, our entering the new year was not a chance occurrence, nor did we enter it simply because we ourselves wished to. For our part, we did so because He wills it, and He has a purpose, and for us there are many reasons. If each of us reflects on his life, on what he has done, what he is doing, and what he ought to be doing, that is, on what he is obliged to do in response to the goodness and long-suffering of God, he will find many things that he should have done and still has to do. And yet, man has shut himself within himself. Satan deceives him, and he imagines that he has no obligations, perhaps not even toward himself. Yet our obligations in response to God's goodness and long-suffering are many. A person is, of course, an individual, but he also belongs to the whole, to a family, to a society, or to the church. He is therefore not insignificant. We cannot simply say, "Go your own way, come now, what do we care? What concern is it of ours?" Nor can we say, as the common expression goes, "Shut the door, go inside, and let them say whatever they like," not to mention the cruder expression people use. No, we have obligations and God will hold us accountable. He did not give us our talents without purpose. Listen to the gospel this coming Sunday, the Sunday of the talents, and see what it says. Apply it to yourself and examine the talents God has given you as a human being. He has given talents to each one of us, including certain gifts that not everyone possesses. We must consider how we are going to use them. These things, then, we have an obligation. Someone may say, "I do not have the strength to take on the burdens of others. I cannot even help myself. What can I do for anyone else? I am an unknown, insignificant person. I am not educated, and 1,001 other obstacles stand in the way. And yet a person always has something he can do for others." Thank you. We have personal obligations, family obligations, and obligations toward the church. Someone will say, "How am I supposed to meet all these? I don't have the means, I can't." Let me help you with that, through prayer. You can't go, you can't run to them, you can't help, you can't have a word with the person, you can't show up, you have no presence, no standing. You can't. But can you not pray? Which of us, when the year changed, realized that during 1977, we had not prayed as much as we should have for our own needs, for the needs of our families and those around us, and for the needs of the church? And who recognized that he truly had failed to do this and said, "This year I am making new resolutions. From now on I will keep a little list at my icon corner, and I will bring each matter on it before God whenever I pray." I will mention my personal needs and the needs of my family, but I will also remember the needs of those beyond my own circle. Beyond that, I have a duty. Remember what God said to Abraham: if even 10 righteous people had been found there, he would not have burned Sodom and Gomorrah. So in the Sodom and Gomorrah of our own day, when all of us say with one voice, without hesitation or doubt, that we truly are living in an age like theirs, what are we doing about it? For which neglected obligation of ours will God not hold us accountable? Every day Satan asks Christ for us, "Give me this man, give me this woman, permit me to take them." Yet Christ does not give them to him. Why does he not give them to him? Because someone is praying, and that prayer carries weight before God. Why will you not give me these people? Because of these 5 or those 10 who pray. This year we thought of placing ourselves among those few who pray, among those anonymous faithful whom we do not know. Because there is a remnant that has not come to terms with the devil. It is what God said to Elijah when Elijah said that he had been left all alone. "That I am the only one left," he says, "only I." "You're mistaken," God tells him. "There are still 7,000 who have not bowed the knee to Baal. You don't know them, but I know them." Even today there are people who have nothing to do with Sodom and Gomorrah, young men and women, wives and mothers, fathers, clergy, and many others. This anonymous multitude is what holds up the heavens. Meanwhile, we do the things we do and say the things we say, and so forth. Have we therefore thought this year of placing ourselves within that anonymous company, so that we too may help hold up the heavens and restrain the wrath that threatens us both from without and from within? If I answer no, I hope I am not speaking falsely. None of this has happened. No new thought and no new resolution. Why? Because we haven't weighed it. We haven't added it up. We haven't come to see that we are guilty on this point, and that we too ought to have some place of our own within this community in which God has placed us. Take a house as an example. A house, in order to be lit, probably needs 5 or 6 or 8 or even 10 lights. But if it does not have 10 lights and has only 8, is the house not still illuminated? Is that the same as having no light at all? Of course it is illuminated. The same is true if it has 6 lights, 5, 4, 3, 2, or even only 1. Is that not better than having no light at all? Of course it is. That is exactly how it is. The person who prays in a household also gives light to the others. He gives them light so that they do not stumble into one another face first. He makes things easier for them. Folk wisdom has a saying, "When the basil is watered, the flower pot is watered too." May everyone in the household be a light. But even if they are not all lights, if there is even one, mercy is shown to that household. God shows forbearance. Satan demands the family for himself, so that he may tear it apart, cast it aside, and blow it to pieces, but for the sake of that one person, Christ does not hand it over. In the same way he would have handed over the church, but for the sake of the few who pray and who are true Christians, he does not hand over the church, despite the weaknesses of both clergy and laity. This, then, is what I say we have failed to put into practice, and I take this opportunity to speak of it now, while we are still at the beginning of the year. Revise the program of your prayer. Bring into it people from outside as well, beyond your own home, though they are not really outsiders, they are our own. Because if you pray for your neighbor, is he a stranger to you? If you pray for the clergy, are they strangers? If you pray for those who govern us, are they strangers? Do we not come from the same baptismal font? Are we not brothers? Do we not share the same sorrows, as we say? There is a unity among us, as Paul says, are only brothers according to the flesh, truly brothers. God is waiting for us. And someone will say, "But will God really listen to us?" I know he will. How does he put it? "Knock, and I will open to you." How does he put it? "Ask, and I will give to you." How does he put it? "Knock, and it shall be opened unto you." What more could he say? He is waiting for us. Has anyone importuned God about these things? No one has. We nearly dried up completely, until almost nothing was left standing. The streams dried up, the rivers dried up, and the fish were left exposed and died. The municipalities poured fuel over them and burned them so that they would not become sources of disease. Did anyone bend the knee and pray? Did anyone make prayer part of his daily rule? Do you understand? God is waiting for us. Did you ask me, and I refused to give? Yet we do not think about these things. But if some little lump appears somewhere in the body, then all the alarm bells begin to ring. Then the paraclesis services begin, and then the cries begin. Does cancer have to appear before we come to our senses? If cancer does not appear, we do not come to our senses. We do not turn to Christ. Yet going to God out of necessity rather than love is not something that moves him. But apart from that, who afterward thanked God for doing this and supplying the land with water for 10 years? Tell me who thanked God. 5 or 10 people thanked him. What did everyone else do? It was a harsh winter, terrible weather. Was it terrible weather or blessed weather? But the villages were cut off, they say. They had no bread. And who told them not to keep any bread? They were passing their time in the cafe. In earlier days, people stayed prepared because they knew better. Now everyone waits for the cart or the motor car to bring bread right to the house. Why aren't you expecting winter to come? Put 5 okas of flour aside in a corner. Put 2 bales of hay aside for your animal. Why not do that much? Of course you'll say to me, there's poverty as well today, with the state we've been reduced to. But the basic problem is not poverty, it is indifference. Indifference is the problem. There are exceptions. I do not say this applies to everyone. Perhaps 5% truly had nothing, but did you have absolutely nothing? Could you not have gathered 5 loads of firewood? Oh, you had it, but you were sitting there playing cards at the coffee shop. And you never went and brought in 5 loads of firewood so that you'd have some, so that you could face 10 days of snow. And why? Because for 10, 20, 30 years no snow had fallen. That was it, you thought. It would never snow again. Who afterward gave thanks for this mercy God showed, despite the damage that occurred. Tell me who did. No one. If he does something on his own, we neither ask him for it beforehand nor thank him afterward. In other words, we do not see God. We do not include God in our work, our family, our very being, or our life. He is something foreign to us. He is far away, somewhere over there beside an oil lamp, with a little oil burning, or beside some small candle. That to us is God. But he is within my life. He cares for me day and night and never forgets me, even if I am a sinner. He remembers me far more than he would if I were righteous. A mother, after all, cares more for her gravely ill child than for all her other children who are well. She does so even if that gravely ill child is the worst behaved of them all. She leaves the others and devotes herself to that one. God acts in exactly the same way. Let no one be afraid because he is a sinner. Do not say, God does not care about me. Untie his hands and you will see how deeply he cares. He is still waiting for you and still giving you time and so much more. This is love, but people do not understand what it means. It is like a walnut that must be cracked open so that you can discover what is inside and understand what the love of God truly is. We see God's love only in terms of money, the flesh, worldliness, and such things. But here we come to see God and his love differently. It is written in Isaiah, I do not know whether this passage is read, the 49th chapter. He says, can a mother forget the infant at her breast? A mother is deeply concerned for her little child. She can hear its voice from far away. And yet, he says, although it seems impossible, sometimes even she may forget her child. Perhaps she is talking about fashion on the telephone, or leaning out the window chatting with another woman across the way, while her child might fall into the fire. But even if a mother does what she should never do, God says, I will neither leave you nor forsake you. Behold, he says, I have engraved you upon my hands. I hold you before me and see you day and night. This is God, do you understand? It is not I who say this. I am no miracle worker. It is God himself. Yet who thanks God even for this alone? Who thanks him? And who places all his troubles before the judgment of God, leaving it to him whether something should happen or not? If it does not happen, I thank you 1,000 times. If it does, I thank you once. Where is that wisdom now? And so, just as we pass through 1977, here comes 1978. Many people at this point may have an objection. What is their objection? But Mr. Panagopoulos, what you are saying has nothing to do with me, because I pray, I always pray. Yes, you do well to pray. But I want to ask you this. Is your prayer joined to anything else? Is it surrounded and supported by anything? Or is it merely a prayer offered out of need, or for some other reason? Does your prayer have its proper setting? Prayer must also be surrounded and supported by love. And love has works behind it. Love is accompanied by works. So there is a threefold unity, prayer, love, and works. All three are enclosed within a shell called faith. Faith is like the shell of a walnut. Break it open, and inside you will find prayer, love, and works. This whole unity must be present in people. And those who have not succeeded in possessing this should take care to acquire it. for they do not know whether they will live beyond 1978. We have entered this year, but whether we shall come out of it, we do not know. I do not know how many entered it, nor how many will leave it. He alone knows. Therefore, each person must take responsibility in these present moments. For when a person merely prays, but at the same time does not also have the works of love toward their neighbor, their prayer is dry. Did you notice what James, the brother of God, says there? He says that telling someone, "Yes, brother, go with God's blessing," that doesn't warm them, he says. Not if you don't give them something for the heating oil, for bread, and so on. So if you can, within the limits of your means, you must help him with his need. Otherwise, he will not be warmed. Through your prayer, you warmed his soul a little, but you did not warm his body. For he has a body as well, and he is more conscious of the needs of his body than of his soul. If you want to see what I mean, remember the place where Christ once took his disciples so that they might rest. But the people, driven by need, discovered where he had gone and brought their sick to him. Christ first healed their sick, and only afterward did he preach and speak to them. He did not speak to them first and heal them afterward. This means that when someone is lying there sick, you cannot simply speak to him about God. First, you must arrange for his injections, a doctor, his medicine, and so on. Then you can speak to him about God. If you merely tell him in words to get well, he will not get well. He needs medicine and a doctor. He needs bread and money for the rent, and perhaps many other things. This is what God desires. God is moved when someone prays for another person or for a particular situation, while at the same time showing through his works a broader love for the neighbor beside him. I once read something that I would like to share with you. I dare say it is very relevant to what I am speaking about at this moment. There was a group of people who had appointed a particular day on which they would always gather to pray. Even here in Athens, I know of one or two places where people gather to pray. They have appointed a particular day on which they meet for prayer. One evening, when the time for prayer came, one member of the group, an elderly man, had not arrived. That night, they were praying especially for a very poor household, asking God to help that family, along with all the other things one might say in such circumstances. The man who did not attend had sent his son in his place. The boy arrived and found the others inside praying. At one point they asked him, "Where is your father? Why did he not come? Is he well?" The boy replied, "My father is well, but he had a great deal of work to do on the farm and could not come. So he sent me. Our wagon is outside, loaded with potatoes, flour, and oil. His prayer is there too. He told me that he is sending his prayer together with the potatoes, the oil, and everything else. So please come and let us take them to that poor man." This is prayer made active through love. It is good to pray in the abstract, asking God to enlighten you, to help that person, and so on, while never putting your hand in your pocket. But if you are able to provide him with warmth, remember that he has a body, children, and a family. It is this love, this prayer embodied in your good works, that moves God. Sadly, most people do not have this. A person does not consider it his duty to seek out someone who is poor. He says, "I do not know anyone like that," as though there were no poor people. There are, "Go and ask the priest of your parish. Go and ask the charitable committee in the parish to which you belong. Go there. There are women serving on the committee. They keep a list and collect offerings in a box belonging to the church. They take out 1 drachma and 60 lepta from it, for no one considers it his duty, when he enters the church, to contribute. He lights candles before the most holy Theotokos, Saint George, Saint Nectarios, and so on. But it never occurs to him to put even 1 drachma into that box. He would rather spend it on a candle. Someone may ask me, should he not light a candle, light 500 candles, but also put 1 drachma there toward this living candle? Pour a little oil into this lamp that is flickering and about to go out. What will they find in the box? What will this committee have to distribute?" The committee every Saturday hands out 30 drachmas here, 20 drachmas there, to 50 families. What are they going to give? Why is it that I, and you, and this person, and that person, Don't set aside a collection, 5 or 10 drachmas a week that we drop in there, so that they could hand out 1,000 drachmas a week, or 2,000 or 5,000. They could hand out 100,000 a week. Who has ever given this a thought? Instead, how we pour out our prayers into thin air, while people go and have supplication services, paraclesis services, chanted at the Panagia Gregoressa, the Watchful Mother of God, and at St. Nectarios, and so on. We have filled heaven with words, but there are no works. We do this now just as we did before we have entered another year as the same people, without making even one decision that I too must respond to someone's need. Saturday evening comes, and you spend so many drachmas on your Sunday enjoyment. Do you send even a small bag of provisions to anyone? Do you offer anything elsewhere? Have you ever gone to buy even a little milk for someone? Have you gone to the milkman there and said to him, I will pay you for the milk. Take a bottle of milk to that elderly woman and another bottle to that family with 4, 5, or 6 children. I will pay the bill. Have you done that? How much of this can you do without dying or destroying yourself? Why do you not do it? Because there is no love. You stand there praying and doing all the rest. But where is your love? Show me your love by your works so that I may know who you are, says St. John. John Climacus says, we offer every form of devotion that costs us nothing. We offer every form of devotion that costs us nothing. These matters have passed unnoticed. And at this point, I would like to remind you that Jesus does not accept prayer without love. Nor, let me add, does he accept love without obedience. There is another virtue called obedience, and many people do not possess it. Why? Because they do not love Christ as they should. For if we love Christ as we should, we would do whatever he says. If anyone loves me, he will keep my word. When I do not keep his commandments, I do not love him. I disregard his commandments. I do not take him seriously or give him due heed, and the consequences are grievous. Christ says, my children, what you failed to do in 1977, have you resolved to do in 1978? No, everything remains the same. The church calls you to fast. You did not fast in 1977. Have you resolved to fast in 1978? Nothing. You pay no attention at all. How then can such a person rightly say that 1977 has passed and that he has entered 1978? How long will this continue? This God, there are certain details that escape our notice. Do you remember what he said to Peter? Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me more than these? Yes, Lord, he says. You know that I love you. He said this to Peter 3 times. Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me more than these? Do you know what he meant by this? From now on, Peter, you will obey. That is how these words are to be understood. Until then, he had followed his own will and had reached the very depths of Hades. Into the belly of Hades, and why? Because he said, I don't know what the others will do. As for me, I'm going to make it, and so on. You're going to make it before the cock crow? Thou shalt deny me thrice. Not even my own prayer is going to hold you up. You will make it all right. You will make it as far as the belly of Hades. You will strike the very gates of Hades, and you will escape from there. And when you have returned, strengthen your brethren. From now on you will obey me. From now on you will follow me. This obedience to Christ is absent from most of us. Consider what Christ says and what we human beings actually do. You will see that, since we do not do what he says, it means that we do not love him. And since we do not love Christ, we do not obey him or take him seriously. So we remain exactly as we were in previous years. Whoever loves Christ carries out his will and obeys him. Whoever reveres him and takes him seriously carries out his will and obeys him. Only when a person obeys Christ is he secure. Then Christ takes responsibility for him. Then he will guard him and watch over him. Then and only then will all these things come to pass. If a person does not do this, he will not succeed. He will be secure and protected only when he obeys Christ. I will give you an example. It is said that a family lived in a mountainous region. The father used to accompany his young son to school, which was outside the village. There were bears in that area, so he would take the boy to school and bring him home again. When the child grew a little older, his father said to him, "Listen, from now on you will go to school by yourself. Be careful not to take another road or stray from the path I have shown you. You must always follow this road." Then he gave him a second instruction. The first was not to stray from the path, but to follow the road his father had shown him. Second, if a bear should suddenly appear before you, stand perfectly still where you are. Do not run, because a bear will not devour you if you remain motionless. Do you understand? Yes, father. And so the boy began going to school alone, along the road his father had shown him. His father, however, secretly followed and watched him. He watched the child just as we do when our child first goes out alone. We stand at the corner and watch as far as the kiosk when we send him to buy some yogurt or something else. We do not yet trust the child completely because he lacks the necessary experience. In the same way, the father secretly watched his son. Then one day, as the boy was walking along the road, a bear suddenly appeared and charged at him. The child stood as still as a pillar, just as his father had told him. The bear came close, placed one paw upon him, and did not devour him. It remained there with its right paw resting on the child, without harming him. From where he was standing, the father steadies himself, bang! He fires a single shot and kills her. So the boy was rid of the bear, and he was overjoyed, and all the rest of it. "Dad, where were you that you saw her?" and so on. "Yes, my child," his father says to him. "It wasn't my killing her that saved you. You were saved because you obeyed what I told you and did nothing according to your own judgment. Had you acted on your own, you would not be here now." This is how God acts. But when you walk along the road he has shown you, when you and I do what he has commanded, then he knows how to destroy all those who surround and threaten us. This obedience is absent from us. A woman once said to me, "You know what the world is like today." "Yes, I know. But I also know that he is above us, and one day the cup will overflow. Then we shall discuss all these things you claim to know." This is precisely what, as you know, is lacking in most of us. A person then must remain both faithful and obedient, faithful to the path and obedient to the commandments. Many of us do not keep the commandments. We keep neither the commandments of the law nor those of grace. The commandments of grace are more subtle, while those of the law are more evident. Many flatter themselves with the satanic thought that they keep most of them. But if you fail to keep even one, it is the same as failing altogether. It is as though you do nothing at all. If you keep the whole law but stumble in one point, you are guilty of breaking the whole law, he says. Let me put it this way. Suppose the first prize lottery number contained 5 fives, 55-55. If you had 4 of those fives, you would have most of the digits. But would you win first prize? No, why? Because you did not have every 5 that was required. You may have had many of them, 4 or 3, but you did not have the complete number. It is exactly the same when a person fails to observe the law. When you do not observe the law, you leave an opening through which Satan has every opportunity to enter. If you yourself open that door, do not expect God to come and protect you. God does not protect you. Do not expect God to guard you when you yourself create the conditions that allow Satan to harm you. Many people blame Satan during holy confession, but do not blame Satan. Satan is not the one at fault. St. Gregory the theologian says, "Why do you blame the wretched one?" That is what he calls him. Satan merely strikes the match. You and I place the gunpowder and laid down the dry brushwood. He only set it alight. Is he to blame? Why does he not set fire to the sea? Because the sea cannot burn. We are the ones at fault. We create the situations ourselves in such a way that Satan is not in the wrong. That is his job. So when we refuse to obey the commandments of Christ, when we refuse to obey and to walk that road he told us to walk, then whatever happens to us, we deserve the fate we get. Examine your past. You will find that whatever happened, happened because of us. Someone may ask, are there never temptations that we ourselves did not create? Are there not temptations that God permits, that God sends? If you are Paul, then yes. But who among us is Paul so that he should be given a thorn to buffet him and keep him from becoming proud? Who among us is like that? We are rags. We are nothing. We create these situations ourselves through our ego, our flesh, our belly, our eyes, our carelessness, and our fashions. We create the conditions through which Satan enters and brings about this whole situation. And that, my beloved, is precisely why the situation remains unchanged. The whole of 1977, with all its filth and weaknesses, has fortunately passed, yet it carries on into 1978 as though nothing had happened. No new decisions were made, and so we could put it this way, one more year has been added to our life. But as I told you at the beginning, this addition of time, this added year, has two sides to it. It can be a blessing and it can be a curse. For those who use this time for good to put right what has happened in the past, to settle their past debts, and to prevent new ones, it is a good thing, it is a blessing. But for those who simply let it pass, it is a curse. Many discussions take place time and again, with non-Christians and with Christians. Non-Christians cannot understand what it is that a person finds. Close to Christ, a person comes to stillness, to hesychia, that true rest of the soul. Everyone else points to ways of finding happiness and peace of soul outside of Christ, outside the church. And you can see how outward-turned people have become today, especially the young, though of course we don't leave out the older ones either. Those who do not recognize the sickness of the soul and those who do not know the physician of the soul think in this way. When do you go to a doctor? Once you recognize your illness, then you go. Many people, although gravely ill and already suffering, have still not discovered the condition they are in. They do not seek Jesus so that they may see a change, find consolation, and find peace. A doctor once put this question to a Christian. What do you find in this so-called Christ of yours? What rest? What peace do you find in him? How do you go to him? The Christian replied, when I became ill and realized that I was sick, I came to you so that you could attend to me, write me a prescription, give me medicine, and make me well. In the same way I recognize that my soul is sick, and I go to that physician. Most people do not know Christ. And among those who do know him, there are some who do not want him. They want a Christ made to suit their own way of life, one who will accommodate their flesh and their weaknesses. They want that kind of Christ with that kind of gospel. But Christ does not fashion such things, as you know. That is precisely why many remain far away. To have an informed judgment about Christ, you must live Christ. The Holy Spirit said it in advance through David, and he says in one of the Psalms, in Psalm 33, taste and see that the Lord is good. Try him, he says, and you will see that the Lord is useful to you, Christos, with an eta, not Christos. The Lord is Christos. He is good to you and of real benefit. People have not tried him. They have rushed to suicide, thinking it a solution, and have done 1,000 other things, without ever making an effort to know Christ. They have made no effort to find him. Those who make the effort to find Christ will see that they need Christ. The human soul was made for Christ alone. There is something I do not know whether you have noticed. Some people try to increase their happiness through material possessions. This is a mistake. It is quite absurd. Imagine putting a few grains of corn in one place and a few fish in another, and then giving the fish to the rooster and the corn to the cat. Neither food is suited to the one receiving it. The rooster wants the corn, and the cat wants the fish. The soul was not made for material things. Suppose I give you a golden basin in which to spit blood. What good does that do you? Roosevelt's daughter was once asked, I do not know whether those of you who read widely have come across this, how happy she felt because of her great wealth. She replied, I am very sorry that you still do not know that happiness is not found in money. That is what she said. Happiness is not found in money. If you wish, visit wealthy homes and see how much misery people have there. They lack neither food nor fine furnishings nor means of transportation. What they lack are the means of communion between souls, and these are given by Christ alone. No one else can give them, only Christ. In such a case, then, a person needs to reflect and discover where he stands and where he ought to turn. For if you throw gold coins and grains of corn before a rooster, as I said earlier, the rooster will kick the coins aside and go looking for the corn and the worms it can eat. There are many people like this. They do not know Christ, the leader of the treasures of faith, love, and obedience. They cast him aside and occupy themselves with material things, imagining that these can bring them happiness. A fable tells how a lion once gave a banquet for the animals of the wilderness. There were choice foods of every kind, beyond anything the human mind could imagine. Among the guests was a pig. The pig came to the table and began sniffing around. The lion said, "Sit down. What are you looking for? Sit at the table," the pig replied. "But there are no acorns anywhere." Many people are like that. They speak about acorns, not about Christ or the kingdom of heaven. They do not speak about the spiritual life to come. They speak about acorns. There is another story that I once read and wrote down. A captain of a whaling ship was sailing in the far north and came to a harbor where there was a small chapel. They came ashore and went to the church. That captain sat down with them as well. When the service was over, the priest there spoke to them in their own language, and so on, "Welcome, safe voyage," and things of that sort. "You who are traveling," he says, "all this time, and there's no church to be found anywhere, right now. In this hour, in here, how did your heart feel? Was your heart filled? Let me tell you the truth, Father," he says. "I was wondering whether we might find a whale. You would sooner find a whale in my heart right now than anything you have spoken about. There are people who go to church, yet remain outside the church. There are people who go to Vespers, yet receive nothing from it. They take nothing away with them, and consequently no change takes place in them. They leave exactly as they entered, if not worse." The Holy Spirit has already dealt with this very case ahead of time. I don't know whether you read the texts of our church, but there is a place where it speaks about people who come into the church. And the service reaches the through the prayers of our holy fathers, the final dismissal, and it's over. Yes, it's over. But where were you traveling in your thoughts? Your mind had gone elsewhere. You have never struggled to take yourself by the ear, as it were, and bring yourself back inside so that you do not keep running outside. You have never made that effort or waged that struggle. You imagine that merely appearing there will somehow change you by magic. But you do not change, and you receive absolutely nothing. The text says, "Often while offering hymns, I found myself committing sin. With my tongue I uttered songs, but in my soul I entertained improper thoughts. Correct both through repentance, O Christ our God, and save me." This is a condition found in many people. It happened in the past, and it still happens. You may ask why. It is because we make no effort and reach no firm decision. Today I shall go to church, and I shall truly be there. Whatever may happen, but if the door shuts behind us or even creaks, we immediately turn to see who came in, what they are wearing and what they are doing. Someone may object, "Is that possible? You are human. Surely you will hear such things." Yet once in Patras, something happened that shows it is possible. A fire broke out one morning in the church of the Evangelistria. The fire brigade arrived. Water was poured everywhere, and there was great commotion at the bell tower, just to the right as one enters, where the stairs lead upward. The whole place filled with smoke. It was a major incident. Many people were inside. Among them was a man who came out 2 or 3 hours later, after the fire had been extinguished and the service had ended. He asked, "What is all this?" They said, "Was there not a fire?" "When did the fire happen?" he asked. "When I came in this morning, everything was fine." They told him, "The fire brigade came afterward, and there was all this commotion." "I didn't notice. I didn't notice the fire." Do you see? That is exactly what we are like during the service ourselves. And since we are not really there, this year we have made a decision to put up a struggle to be there. Take a place in church, not next to the lady you're going to sit and chat with about the house and so on, next to someone you don't know. Sit off in some corner, a stranger among strangers, so that you can pray. Why did you go to church? To show off your outfit? Why? What was your purpose? All these basic things we are discussing now have remained just as they were in 1977. We have not changed. We have made no decision about any of these things that we need. Now there is something else I would like to mention. A proverb says, "Never borrow sorrow, not even from the past." I do not know whether you have heard it, but this proverb does exist. Never borrow sorrow. Someone may ask, how can a person borrow sorrow? The proverb answers, not even from the past. Although God desires a person to be content, to remain composed, not to drown in a spoonful of water, as the saying goes, and not to be gloomy, embittered or tormented, Satan manages to turn his life into a martyrdom. And this is what happens to a person because he has overlooked one important detail. He does not trust in God. Worrying about tomorrow makes him miserable, and the things Satan makes him imagine will happen to him, whether because he has a family or because he is in poor health, may never happen at all. And yet he is distressed ahead of time, and he loses his good cheer. Glory to thee, O God, that glory to thee, O God, would not come out of his mouth. Why? Because he was not paying attention, or someone else borrows his troubles from the past as well. He remembers things that happened back in 1910 and brings them all up again. Ah, if only this or that had happened then. Come now, leave those things behind. Press forward from where you are today. What did the Apostle Paul say? What did he teach? Paul says, "One thing I do, forgetting what lies behind and reaching forward to what lies ahead, I press on toward the prize. Whatever happened has happened. It is over. Do not bring it all back again. Let us move forward now." Why keep discussing the past? Why bring it up again? Why load it onto your mind and torment yourself until you cannot even raise your hand, make the sign of the cross, and say, "Glory to you, O God"? Why do you do this? Because Satan is deceiving you. Listen to something you must keep in mind. I believe I once used this image in another talk. Man stands between heaven and earth. Man stands between heaven and earth. His purpose is to pass from here to there. And to pass from today into tomorrow, there is a bridge in between that connects the two. Yesterday was what day? Wednesday. And tomorrow we have Friday. So what is the bridge between these 2 days? Thursday. So today we are crossing this little bridge called Thursday. Tomorrow, what will we have? Thursday behind us and Saturday ahead. We will lift up Friday and set it down as a little bridge so that we can cross into Saturday. On ordinary days, this little bridge can bear only a certain weight, say 10 kilos. Do not bring onto it the weight of Saturday, Sunday, and Monday as well, turning 10 kilos into 100. It will collapse beneath you. You cannot carry all that. What does Christ say? Sufficient for the day is its own trouble. Tomorrow will take care of itself. But you never say God will provide. That is where the harm is done. The saying tells us, do not borrow sorrow, but when will you stop borrowing sorrow? The other one, Satan, sets before you so many worries, imagined events, and alarming possibilities. You will stop when you learn to say, God will provide. If you do not learn to say, God will provide, you will always be sorrowful and tormented. Learn then to open only one little envelope each day. I remember my mother asking my father, what shall we prepare for tomorrow? And he would answer, let us wait until morning comes. He never once gave orders the night before about what should be cooked for the next day. I remembered that from when I was a child, and now, of course, after 50 years, I find that in reality this is exactly how it ought to be done. Let morning come. Let us first live to see the dawn. But we torment ourselves with thoughts. What is going to happen? The children are growing up. What if our daughter never marries? And then this worry and that worry. Yet the next day a car may strike them and they may all be gone. All that remains of their worries is wasted sorrow. Why? Because for them God does not provide. Satan is like a penniless vagrant with an empty tent. He has nothing, God has everything, yet Satan makes these people feel poor. They have learned nothing from the past. They learned nothing. Think how many things a person chases after, again and again things he never once attained, and yet they left him deeply tormented in this world. Examine yourselves, you will find that you are carrying all sorts of dreams, all sorts of anxieties, all sorts of torments. There are various torments, but they never actually come to pass. Satan simply loads them into your head in order to torment you and make you suffer, for no other reason. Therefore, if we do not understand it in this sense, we should say, God will provide.